Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, Health for Partners After Sexual Betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSats certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
Sometimes listeners want to know about triggers.
I'm dealing with the aftermath of my husband's affairs, and he still works the same job that he did when he was acting out. It's a job that allows him to hide his goings-on and one that he stated was a previous trigger for his acting out. The whole 16 and a half years we've been together, he's acted out. In the beginning, what I thought it was just pornography. It ended up being, I found out 2.5 years ago, he had been with multiple prostitutes. I only found out a very small portion of that until about a month ago. How do you cope with all of that when you still have to deal with unavoidable triggers?
Well, of course you would feel traumatized by hearing all that information. And I gotta tell you, Stephanie, that's a staggered disclosure. That's finding out little bits and pieces about your husband's behavior throughout a time period, making you feel insecure, unsure, and unsafe. So what we gotta do is set up a situation whereby you get with a specialist to do a formal disclosure so you can hear everything at one time in a safe environment.
And that is so important, to be able to find that safety and stabilization when you're getting information like this. And we're talking about disclosures. This week, I had two colleagues from AppSats, the most respected colleagues in the world. They put out a version of how to do disclosures for the sex addict and also for the partner. And so you can go to Amazon.com and get the first version that's out for the addict. And it is by Janice Caudill, C-A-U-D-I-L-L, and Dan Drake, D-R-A-K-E. I had the pleasure of reviewing their manuscript because I wrote a testimonial, and I just really believe that people can't just do disclosures. I mean, you've got to have a trained professional to make sure it's safe for both the partner and the addict. And it needs to be spelled out as to what you can expect and what you want, and the questions you need to have answered, and the boundaries that are set, and the self-care before, during, and after the disclosure. And their books happen to address all these concerns. We have never seen anything like it. It's like the Bible for disclosures. So I highly recommend that you take a look at it, and just know that in the next month or so, they're going to have some other versions out too, but this is a great guideline if you're wanting your husband or wife to do a disclosure with you. It'll help you to know what is a disclosure and why is it so important that it's done with integrity and respect and structure and formality. That's why we call it a formal disclosure. And so that's exciting. And for any of my listening audience out there that didn't know it, I know we talked a little bit about it last week when Mari Lee was on, and she said that she was excited for my book to come out. But my workbook for sex addicts on how to develop empathy for their partner to help her heal is finally out. It came out. It's on Amazon. And it is a workbook for the sex addict, and it really just goes through the the process of how do you develop empathy? You know, when an addict has been discovered, and that's usually the case, somebody finds out, typically the partner. When the addict has gone through a discovery, I always recommend that three things have to occur. One is you start really working on the individual, the addict's recovery, and you set up those important tools. You know, you get them into groups and you get them with sponsors or mentors, and you have them read the information, like if they're going to Sex Addicts Anonymous, then they read their green book and they go through the 12-step process, step by step, with a sponsor, temporary or permanent. And they get those fellowship call lists and they call. They call to share about themselves and they call to check on each other. And they develop that intimacy that you want to see in your own home if you decide that you want to stay with the addict. And then I'm also a believer that they need to work with somebody who has had specialized certification in sex addiction. Because here's the truth, guys. Oftentimes, an addict will lie to a therapist or coach. Now, I know you don't know. I was teasing you. And so you need a specialist to know when somebody's lying. Now, I'm trained in neurolinguistic programming, and as long as that man or woman is right-handed, I can tell when they answer a question honestly versus when they construct the answer. They either remember it or they construct it. And that's because the eye movement occurs in a special way. But that's only with right-handed people. Believe it or not, if they're left-handed, they don't use the same process. So already I've got a bit of an advantage in that I can tell. And then, of course, from my niche experience with this type of addiction, you learn when somebody's not being 100% honest. So that really helps. You know, the other day I had a couple come in and they were going to go into the polygraph questions, and he actually had sought out a polygrapher and gotten his own polygraph done and passed. And he was telling her she was crazy for making him do another one, but he went ahead and said he was willing. And so, of course, we don't want these polygraph questions to be we don't want to trip up an addict. What we want is to ascertain the truth so that people can start working on their relationship and their own integrity. So she was asking, and she said, well, you know, here's the questions I want to use. And she goes, would you change any of them? And he was there, and I said, well, yes, I would. I would change one of them. And she said, what's that? And she said, and I said, I would ask on the polygraph, have you looked on the internet for ways to, what was my exact wording? Basically what I was saying is, have you looked for ways to lie to the polygrapher or lie on the test or you get the drift. And I saw he very quietly blinked his eyes like about six times. And I knew. I knew that he hadn't been honest, and I knew that he had gotten on the internet to see how he could cheat the polygraph. And of course he said, no, that, you know, I have not done that. And that's fine, because the other reason we talk to addicts and ask them to you know, give them the questions ahead of time is because it's oftentimes a mechanism to get them to be honest. And so they may not be honest right there in your office, but within that 12-hour window before they go to the polygrapher, they will come clean. And so he did. he actually told her he would not pass two of the questions. And so now we're talking about what he can do to get into sexual integrity. Because the truth of the matter is, he's got to have good, healthy recovery before he can be healthy to anybody else in his family. You know, and I believe that can happen. I am an advocate for sex addicts that are confused but end up wanting recovery. So that's a little bit about that process, and it's pretty tough on both the partner and the addict. Now, I'm wondering what is going on in your life. You know, you're listening to the show and you're probably in all different phases of your own personal recovery. And so we oftentimes have experts that teach our listening audience about many of the different resources that are available out there, styles of therapy, individual work, partner work, couples work, family systems, you know, that kind of stuff. And today, we've got two experts that are going to be talking about what is the difference between sobriety and full recovery. Actually, they're talking about how do you move beyond sobriety into full recovery. And they are a married couple, Dan and Angie Andrew. And they work together to make things safe for the coupleship. Now, Angie is a board-certified biblical counselor and a board-certified advanced life coach. She is a trained mentor of the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists, that's APSAD, and she's a certified partner mentor for Bravehearts. And she is absolutely passionate about helping women remove the obstacles that prevent them from living full, contented, and meaningful lives. So we're going to talk to her about what does she do with partners while we talk with Dan, who is a redeemed warrior. He's a certified sexual integrity mentor through Bravehearts, and he too has completed his training in life coaching and in sexual addiction curriculum for the American Association of Christian Counselors. And he's completed training in marriage works. So I can't wait to hear what they have to offer and what they have to teach us today. You know, I want you to get the right resources to get healthy. And I also want you to juggle your life so that your whole life is not about being a partner of a sex addict. You have to find a sweet spot in your own recovery where you say, you know what? I am more than being a betrayed partner. I'm a vibrant woman who loves to exercise, or I'm a vibrant mother who dearly loves her kids and wants to be 100% present for them, or I am an energized woman who recognizes my strengths, and even though these bad things have happened to me and I have likely wondered why I wasn't enough, I also have in my own recovery been able to ascertain why his sex addiction wasn't about me. And that is so important. So I want you, no matter where you are in your recovery, to at some point access your own, what I call post-traumatic growth. You know, how have you realigned yourself with your own body, mind, and spirit, and you absolutely can appreciate your own strengths, your own weaknesses. You have this compassion for yourself. You're not overly critical. Now, if you just discovered the sex addiction, this is going to be hard for you because you're in trauma state, and we understand that. However, if you could pick a word that's positive, that describes you, and put it a couple of places, in the house, in the car, in the office, in your closet, in the medicine cabinet, wherever, to remind you that you are resilient, or you are strong, or you are determined, or you are loving. You know, just remember, we need those props to remind us of our strengths when we're in crisis. And that's what I want you all to do as a partner. There's all sorts of reasons for crisis, but there's very little crisis that is as monumental as partner and sexual betrayal. So you're going to get some tips and some tools and some advice today from two people that really have made it their mission to help individuals and couples get healthier, find happiness, and grow. So I am so excited that Dan and Angie are on the line to help us today. Hey, Dan and Angie, welcome to Partner Recovery Radio. How are you?
Very good, Carol. Thank you for having us.
Oh, I was thrilled to have you. Mm-hmm. Hi, Angie. You know, you two have great qualifications, and you got your own story that actually has led you to this part of your life. And so I was wondering if each one of you would take a moment and tell our listening audience a little bit about you as well as what you're currently doing as a result of this crisis.
Okay. So I had a 35-plus year relationship with inappropriate habitual sexual behaviors. Those behaviors contributed to two failed marriages in my life. As a result of that, I entered my first recovery support group back in 2005. That was a divorce recovery support group. And in that group, I experienced for the first time in my life being loved well, being accepted for who I was, being accepted for my messy emotions, anger and sadness and scare. And I stayed in that ministry or in that group for a while and eventually met Angie. After another period of time, we began dating. And after a period of time, I told her of my struggle. She was the first person that I ever told that I had this problem with inappropriate sexual behaviors. And that was a result of my shame that I felt I needed to keep it hidden from everybody, including other men, that if they knew the real me, they would reject me and they would run screaming for the exits. So very quickly after that, I entered sexual addiction recovery. I joined a support group at our local church. I was first just a participant. Then after some time, I transitioned into a table leader and then eventually into overseeing a support group. And I've been able, as a result of that getting into the sexual addiction recovery, I have been able to make changes in my life that allowed me to modify the behavioral side of my addiction and to get my physical acting out or sobriety in check from the day that I told Angie. And that may be an uncommon story, and I don't try to say that with pride. That was just my experience, and I realize that a lot of men that I've walked alongside, that it's not as easy for them, and I understand that. And so
well, and Dan,
I would say
I ask
that
you, Can I ask you, Dan, what was it about Angie that made it feel safe enough to share that history?
Well, from the minute we started dating, I think there was just a special bond for us, and she felt safe. I had a fear that she may run screaming to the exits, like I mentioned before. And at the same time, I just had this underlying feeling that she may be safe. So,
okay.
I described the first 8 years of my recovery as the first layer of recovery. So for that, I did what I knew to do. I went to support groups. I actually went away to a men's intensive weekend, actually a couple of them. One was specific to sexual integrity, sexual addiction issues. The other was just more of a men being called to be men type weekend. I read a lot of recovery books, but I never really addressed the heart issues underneath the addiction, like some of my childhood trauma and some of the things that made me react in the way that I reacted and led me to my coping or medicating behaviors. And I also never had any real accountability with other men in my life for those first 8 years. So another key part of our story is about 4 years ago now, or 4 years ago this coming fall, I blew up our life as we knew it by coming clean on how I hadn't been. Actually, Angie initiated that, helped me with coming clean around not being honest around my mental sobriety, because that was something that I would check in periodically with her around. And that just really kind of rocked her trust level in me, understandably so. And it really just threw both of us into a deeper level, what I would call the second layer or level of recovery. So some of the things that were a byproduct of that revelation to Angie was, you know, I ended up stepping down from my leadership position or overseeing of this sexual integrity support group. It resulted in an out-of-house separation for me for about 9.5 months, where we both worked really hard on ourselves and some on the coupleship. And I started looking at the deep core wounds from my childhood. Like part of my story is being given up for adoption when I was 12 days old. And so I had not only then my adopted family, those family of origin issues, but I had huge rejection and abandonment issues. I had attachment issues, and I would say intimacy disorder issues as well. So some of the fruits that I have seen after the second deeper level of recovery is I have a better understanding of the addiction. I think for the first 8 years, I didn't really understand it. I heard one guy in recovery that I sat with saying, I just want to be, he said with a deep sigh at the end of his check-in, he said, I just want to be normal, but I don't know what normal is. I've never been normal. So part of that, I think, for me as an addict was trying to figure out what's normal and what isn't. And I also think that those first 8 years in the support groups that I was in and the men I was walking alongside, that the overarching belief was that this is as good as it's going to get. And after I started doing the deep emotional healing work, I began to believe that true freedom was possible. And
oh,
then
I
lastly,
get that.
I think, and yeah. Mm-hmm. Lastly, I think, and most importantly, was that we developed a more open and intimate communication, or I did, not only with Angie, but with others.
Well, you know, we always say
Angie,
that what you do in your groups, you know, whether it's a 12-step group or whether it's a Braveheart group or an Every Man's Battle group, when you form that intimacy with the fellowship, it plays out in your relationships too. So it sounds like you and Angie had a really good bond for you to feel safe enough. I was going to ask Angie, Angie, what would you say your story was when you think about the two of you?
Well, as Dan mentioned, we met in divorce recovery. Unfortunately, I had also had two failed marriages prior, but for different reasons. And I had been taking like a 2-year break just to get to know myself better, do just some deeper healing. And obviously, I figured my picker was broken, so I really wanted to just do some work around that. So when I met Dan, like he said, we were very intentional about our dating because we didn't want to hurt our children or any of that. And for me, it was interesting because in my prior two marriages, I had ignored a lot of the red flags because of my own insecurities and woundedness and trauma from my past. And this time with Dan, I didn't. So that initial time that it came out, it was because I had seen red flags in our courtship. And I knew that I was worth asking the questions. So I did ask the question, and thankfully he was ready to get well and wanted to get well. So we started that process. I started going to support group as well and also became a leader there and walked through it. And this really wasn't necessarily traumatizing from the standpoint of I had just met him, but it definitely touched on some past trauma for me that I didn't realize at the time. And that was unfortunate. So, but we did, I could tell that he was wanting to get well, but we didn't have specialized help in the beginning. And I think that was part of our setback and not necessarily getting right to the root of the problem right away. And so that is part of our passion now, is wanting to help people get plugged in all the right places as soon as they possibly can. When everything came out the second time, the reason for the separation was, you know, he had promised me when we got married that he wouldn't lie to me. That was one of our, you know, that was one of my boundaries for sure. And because he had lied to me, that was the cause of the separation. I needed him to know that it was very important that needed to be addressed, and that wasn't okay. For me, at that 4 years ago also, I had been in counseling the whole time, working on my own stuff. And at that 4-year mark, though, I was able to do some more trauma work and realize that I had some sexual abuse in my past that I hadn't really defined as sexual abuse. And that was causing some PTSD around Dan's issues as well. So it was all kind of blended together. Thankfully, with the help of a trauma therapist, I was able to get kind of to the bottom of that. So I've heard this saying before that we say, damn it, I mean, thank you. I mean, it was a terrible time. I wouldn't want to go through that, what we did 4 years ago. And what's also true is I definitely wouldn't trade what we have now and what I have now in my own healing and my own recovery.
Oh, wow. And, you know, so many partners that I talk to, there's a part of them that knows that they need to do the work if the coupleship is going to improve, and yet they have resentment. It's kind of that damaged feeling. They have resentment that they have to do the work. And then when they do it, they figure out that the work really helps them to feel whole. So I really appreciate the fact that both of you have made it your mission to get to become specialized in this so that you can help people as efficiently as possible. I got some questions for you, if I may. One of the things that I wanted to know is that you have this platform where you say it's not just about the sobriety, it's about true recovery. So I wondered if, Dan, can you talk about the addict's struggle with sexual addiction, and what is the difference between achieving sobriety or working towards full recovery? What do you believe is full recovery?
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, I'll give you a definition of sobriety that I actually, it's one that I've adapted from Mark Laser of Faithful and True Ministries out of Minneapolis. His definition of sobriety, and again, mine that I've adapted, is having sex with anyone other than your spouse, including yourself. So the sobriety side of it is about stopping the unhealthy, inappropriate, habitual sexual behaviors. some men can stop that. Some men can stop that without doing the deep work. But true recovery and freedom, I believe, requires the deep, hard emotional healing work. So AA, if I might, steal something from them, their definition of a dry drunk is they may still suffer from unhealthy, so they're able to stop drinking, but they may still suffer from unhealthy habits, both intentionally and internally. In short, while they have quit drinking, the individual has yet to deal with the emotional baggage that led them to alcohol in the first place. And so they can stop the drinking. They haven't dealt with the underlying root issues, and they still have the unhealthy relationships, not only with themselves, but with others. So, and I think a part two of recovery is discovering why we do what we do, and then identifying the medicating and coping strategies. So I've come up with a definition of recovery that I hope will help the listeners understand the difference of what I just said about sobriety and what true recovery is. So I say that recovery from any addiction is not about just stopping the behaviors, but doing the deep emotionally healing work around the root causes that were underneath the initial development of addictive coping behaviors. In order to be emotionally healthy or mentally and spiritually well, sex addicts need to feel worthy of love, not only by others, but by themselves. They need to be able to be vulnerable and emotionally intimate with their spouses and other safe men. Recovery is about how to find healthy ways of getting our needs met for acceptance and love. Effectively dealing with the root issues allows all of this to take place. It may take time and a lot of hard work and treatment to get to that point, but it is crucial to the recovery. Recovery is about being emotionally healthy enough to choose sobriety over the addiction because the recovering addict believes he is worth it and likes who he has become. So that is what I believe is the difference between sobriety and recovery.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And like you said, you took that definition straight out of the big book, AA. And what do you think are some of the most common measures of sobriety? And I'm going to ask you, Dan, to answer that, and then I'm going to ask Angie, what do you look for when you're looking at sobriety?
Okay. Yeah, so I'm gonna break it into two parts. Part of the support groups that I've been in, we actually check in around both. So there's physical sobriety. So under physical sobriety would be if you've been having an emotional or physical affair, is have you completely cut those off? Have you stopped them? Have you deleted the phone number? Have you blocked the number? Have you changed your phone number? Whatever it takes to end that affair and to protect yourself from it reinitiating it. So if pornography and masturbation has been a problem for you, have you stopped it? Again, do you have the protective measures in place for that? Do you have a filter on your internet? Are you in accountability with other men? Are you having accountability reports sent to other men? And then have you eliminated any other crossing of the flesh behaviors, not only with affairs, but that could involve soliciting prostitutes or going to massage parlors, etc. So that's kind of the physical sobriety, the things that would be a measure of, whether you've got that under control. And then we also check in around mental sobriety. So the things that are important in that are, do you have custody of your eyes? And then do you have control of your thought life / fantasies? And also another part of that is if you have been struggling lately, maybe the temptation level is a little higher. Maybe it's you feel a little more bombarded, that the defenses are weaker, is checking in with yourself and looking under the hood and saying, asking yourself, what's going on? Am I feeling stressed right now? Am I feeling angry? Am I feeling sad? So those are measures that I believe are things that you can look to around sobriety.
I think what I would say, what I would look for in the addict is for sure those consistent, faithful actions over time that we talk about. Also, is he connecting with guys? Is he calling guys in the morning? Does he have a sponsor? Is he, you know, checking in? Is he communicating with me? Is he letting me know? I don't necessarily need to know he's struggling. What I want to know is, what are you doing about that struggle? If you're anxious and you're tempted, you know, to act out, then what are you doing to replace that or to get that need met in a healthy way? You know, knowing that he's doing the behaviors to address, you know, behaviorally, but then also to address whatever is going on in him emotionally that he would typically, you know, medicate himself with acting out.
Now, I'm curious because so many groups say, oh, the partner shouldn't worry about that, shouldn't be looking at how many tools he's using or shouldn't be managing the fact that he's not doing his reading or he's not calling fellowship or whatever. How do you reckon that? Because I myself believe this is a relational issue and the wife does need to be involved. But I'm wondering what your thoughts are, Angie.
I agree. I think it's a more... not a matter of controlling whether they're doing it. And I know a lot of times I hear that the addicts say, well, you're trying to control my recovery. No, I'm actually just trying to, you know, here's what I need to see from you so that I feel safe. You know, if you choose not to do those things, here's what I'm going to do to keep myself safe. We can't make someone do those things. But again, if the goal here is a marriage that is, has a good communication, is emotionally connected, spiritually connected, and physically connected, there has to be safety. In order to have safety, you have to have trust. And so I think communicating it can be extremely difficult. And sometimes if the addict is defensive, then it makes it even more difficult. So I don't know. I think the first thing, if you can kind of create that level of safety to be able to talk about it, I think it's very helpful. It's very helpful for the spouse to know and to be able to see, because let's be honest, their words really don't mean anything for quite a long time. So the actions, and for him to be able to tell me and for him to understand what he's actually doing and why he's doing it is very helpful to build trust. So if the addict could just see that they're actually, you know, not being controlled, but they have a great capacity to help their spouse to be able to trust them again and to rest in their love again and to, you know, just have that healthier communication, you know, then maybe they would think differently of it.
Absolutely. And that's exactly how I feel that, you know, you said it, you nailed it when you said some of these things are important to make you feel safe. And that's what's due you now that you have discovered this or he's come clean and you're working on rebuilding the relationship, which means rebuilding trust. Now, I'm going to ask you, because I know that you two work together and you also work separately on your own individual groups and ministries, what tools do you think are helpful for couples in general to get healthier, to develop that trust, and to maintain accountability?
I would say one of the first things that I think of is education, that both parties need to understand, you know, the addict needs to understand sex addiction and the partner needs to understand the betrayal trauma. And they both need to understand the other as well. You know, the partner needs to have a clearer understanding of what sex addiction is. It also helps them not take it, you know, helps us not take it as personal. It doesn't take it away, but it definitely can be helpful. And the same, you know, with the addict, for him to be able to understand about or her, the betrayal trauma, definitely can be helpful for the partner and can help them hopefully get to that place of empathy.
And Dan, what about you? What are some tools that you think are really helpful for couples?
Yeah, so when we were separated, we used to do a Fanos check-in. I'm not sure if you or the listeners are familiar with that. There are probably quite a few different
types of check-ins. I just gave one last hour. I'm sorry. I just threw into a couple.
Yeah.
Because
so.
it's one of the easiest check-ins there is, and it's positive as well as it holds people accountable. Tell our listening audience what a Fanos is.
Yeah, so it stands for, it's an acronym. The F stands for feelings, A for affirmation, N for needs, O for ownership, and in this particular instance, S for sobriety from the addict standpoint. And so we did that when we were separated. We still do another form of check-in most days, but when we were separated, we would take turns doing it, and it was very helpful to be able to share all of those things with each other. So,
I think another thing that's important is because this recovery is, you know, a couple year process for sure, is to be able to, as a couple individually, to kind of reevaluate where you're at in your recovery and what things are adding value, what things are, is there anything that needs to be added? Is there anything that, you know, is still good but not necessarily as helpful as it was before? Because we can get in a rut, I think, too, of, you know, certain kinds of recovery behaviors and groups and all kinds of different things. So it's just always, we found it really helpful to do that every couple months or so, just to reevaluate everything. And that also includes the check-in and how we're doing it, how we're doing sobriety check-ins, how many times a week, or, you know, just kind of not getting, it's not a one size fits all. So whatever you guys need, whatever the coupleship needs right now and what would be best to help us move forward, it's kind of looking at that, because sometimes there's just a little tweak that can be made or something that could be added and that can just open up a whole nother, you know, realm of understanding and education about, you know, this issue.
Absolutely. And I know you believe in the red, yellow, green circles. And I thought maybe you could share with our listening audience, they may have heard of inner, middle, and outer circles, but your circles are a little bit different. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So if you can imagine a bullseye type drawing or representation picture, has three circles, with red being one circle and then an outer circle around that being a yellow circle, and then a green circle. Green would be the center circle, yellow the middle, and red the outer. Red, and those represent behaviors. And if you think about it as in relation to a traffic light, they're red for stop. So that would be the inappropriate behaviors that are definitely not in any way acceptable. There are yellow behaviors, which are maybe the edging behaviors where a guy is trying to get away with as much as he can without actually crossing the flesh line or masturbating, for example. And then there are there's the green zone or green circle, which is the healthy behaviors. Because one of the things that we find as an addict when I know I spent a lot of time pursuing my addiction and being involved in it. And so when you stop those behaviors, you have these voids in your life. And it's like, what do you do with yourself? What do you do with this free time that now is free? And so it could be taking up a hobby that you used to enjoy and you've stopped doing, or establishing a new hobby, or, you know, some of it is taken up by going to recovery meetings. Some of it is taken up by reading recovery books. But so those are the things that would fall into the green circle. Also self-care, like going out for a walk, finding some healthy way to release stress, maybe by exercising, and those type things, going for a going for a massage to a legitimate massage parlor, for example, taking a hot bath, you know, just all of those things that are self-care.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, as well as it helps to really identify those behaviors that are going to be helpful versus not so helpful. Now, let me ask you, what accountability tools do both of you use to feel safe or to maintain good sexual integrity?
Could you repeat that real quick? I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that question.
Well, you know, I know that accountability tools are really important. And for me, the three circles, which is a lot like what you were discussing, helps an addict know what are the deal-breaking behaviors, what are the slippery slope behaviors, and then what are the healthy outer behaviors, the circle behaviors that you want to work on together. And I'm wondering if you have other accountability tools. And where you may have gotten lost is that accountability tools stand for you to stay in sexual integrity, and accountability tools, Angie, for you to keep working on your own self-care, your own self-compassion, and your own personal work.
Okay, yeah. So, like for me, it's being, like I said, the first 8 years, that first level of recovery, I really wasn't in accountability with anyone. I wasn't making or receiving phone calls, doing a periodic check-in or a regular check-in with them, and also even with Angie. But one of my favorite check-ins that I do, it actually uses an acronym called SASHET, S-A-S-H-E-T. And they stand for sad, angry, scared, happy, excited, tender. So those are the six main emotions, and a man in his check-in can claim one or two of them, or he can claim all six and then give a brief context around that. And I find that in my recovery groups or in my accountability phone calls, when I'm able to do that, that it just is really... it relieves a lot of pressure. It's almost like a pressure relief valve for me. I can offload some of those negative feelings. Like when I was, out of house separation, I'm sure Angie was the same way, but there were many times when I was really angry at her. And for me to be able to offload that with my men that I talk to, my safe men in my community, was really helpful for me, because then it didn't come out sideways on her. Another thing that was important for me was to have an internet filter in place. And part of that was being wise enough to know that I shouldn't be the one in charge of that. So I found someone else that I gave the code to so that I couldn't get in there and disable the filter. This was not a problem for me, but for other men, if social media is a gateway or some area that leads them to edging behaviors or acting out behaviors, I would say a man needs to get off of those. And that might make some men react pretty strongly to that, because I know that's a big part of their life, but if it's necessary, that's what you need to do. Recovery groups, I would recommend being in at least one, maybe numerous ones for a period of time. Create a community of safe men. Come up with your own red, yellow, green zone plan. Do the deep healing emotional work with a trained sexual addiction or CSAT therapist. I would say you could engage a trained coach or mentor. One of the things that Angie and I can do is we can look at what people are currently doing and help them see the blind spots, see if there's any holes in their recovery plan as we see it. And we can help them keep on track with what their therapist or counselor is telling them to do in between appointments. And lastly, I think I don't personally do a lot of traveling, but I've been in recovery with men that do. And if they're traveling, you know, have a plan and be able to share that with their spouse. Say, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to block the pay-per-view and the TV, you know, whatever those things might be that will keep them safe. And then one other thing, I guess, that I did and still do is I can bookend. So if I know I'm going to be going to an event that I feel will cause a lot of anxiety, which for me also increases my desire to medicate in unhealthy ways, is to reach out and let my community know, hey guys, I'm going to this today. I'm really kind of nervous about this. And I don't want to do anything inappropriate. And then after it's over, that's the bookending part of it, sending out another text or making another phone call and saying, okay, I made it through. Okay. Thank you for, you know, thank you for your support.
Yeah, those are all great accountability tools. Angie, can you think of any that hold you accountable?
Definitely community. I think it's especially important as leaders in this industry or, you know, people that are doing coaching and mentoring that we also continue our work, you know, not to assume, oh, we've arrived in any way, shape or form, but to continue to be that example of doing our work. And what I love, too, is after, you know, this, after you've been in recovery for a while, it just becomes a way of life. It's just something that gives you such life when you're connected to community. And so it becomes easier over time to do. And it's just part of who we are now. And it's something that I enjoy and will always continue to do. So I definitely try to have, you know, accountability with community, checking in with myself. You know, again, I just did this recently and just reevaluating like what else needs to be happening in my recovery right now. What season am I in? What needs to be addressed? Do I need to do, you know, another deeper dive in any area? And what came up for me was time to address some codependent issues that I have. And so I stepped out and went to a 12-step group. And so just trying to, you know, now start looking at that and seeing how I can address that. So I think always, again, just looking for what's that next right step and just, you know, getting into that life of recovery. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I told everybody before you two came on that you are an APSATS coach. And so somehow, some way, after all this came out and you got healthy, you decided to become an APSATS coach to further your journey. Tell us, why'd you pick APSATS?
I love the way that APSATS addressed the betrayal trauma as a separate, like an entity, that it was important to identify the betrayal trauma for the partners and that it needed to be addressed. And the way that APSATS goes about it was just very clear and concise ways to help a woman move or a partner move into health and address that issue. I think it's definitely a necessary part of recovery. And I like how you said earlier in the podcast about post-traumatic growth, you know, and I know that what's true, you know, that's possible. And I know one of the things that a lot of ladies, partners sometimes think, well, it's just his problem. I don't need to get help. But you know what, in order to get to the post-traumatic growth, you have to actually address the trauma. So it's just really important. And I think it's important because if a partner, you know, if some partners, I think they think they can just leave the addict and everything will be okay. And there's nothing that couldn't be further from the truth. And, you know, we all know that the trauma needs to be addressed so it doesn't continue. So I just love that there's APSATS out there to help us, you know, train us to be able to help the partners well.
Absolutely. And as we begin to wrap up this podcast, I'd like to know from each one of you, Dan, you starting first, what do you believe that successful recovery looks like? I mean, we've been talking about how to get there. What does it look like when you are in successful, full recovery?
Okay. Yeah, so I think you know, it's having an understanding first and foremost that our wounds taught us our survival mechanism. So for me, it was very a big sense of relief once I learned that there were reasons why I gravitated towards unhealthy behaviors. And so it, like I said, it gave me a sense of relief to know that I wasn't sick or defective or perverted. And so just knowing that gave me a lot of peace. I didn't use that as an excuse and say, well, you know, I had this happen to me as a kid, and so therefore, but I used it as a sense of understanding. And so through my recovery, the way that I can assess for myself or another man is, you know, has the power or the pull of the addiction diminished? So one of the big markers for me is knowing that I don't want to go back ever to the man that I used to be. And, you know, I am aware, thanks to the help of one of my therapists, of being in tune with what's going on inside of me. I used to think I wasn't anxious at all, but I am really a fairly anxious person. And so just being aware of that helps me to realize that is a big trigger for me as far as the power of the addiction. And the things I talked about, reaching out and bookending, that's helpful in that. So I can also say the choice to protect my healing. That is a choice that I make every day. Again, that goes to liking who I am now versus liking who I used to be. So that means continuing to do the things that I know have been problematic. Continuing to avoid the things that I know were problematic in the past. My electronics to Angie are an open book. She can take my laptop at any time. She can go into my email at any time. She can go into my phone at any time. I don't have anything that I'm afraid that she would see. And another benchmark, I think, is that there is more emotional intimacy. There's more emotional intimacy for me with Angie. There's more emotional intimacy with me, with the men in my safe community. And then also I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, we've only got about 45 more seconds, and I was kind of curious. You've given us some great ideas and tools and markers to work from. Angie, what would your answer be?
I think for me, my definition of a successful recovery for myself is that I am beginning more and more to accept and love myself for who I am, good, bad, and ugly. And therefore, that helps me then accept Dan where he's at, good, bad, and ugly.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Obviously, more unconditional without the fear that you're being duped. Guys, thank you so much for being on our show and modeling that couples can not only survive sex addiction, but they can thrive, because you really have done a nice job of that. I wish you the best and keep us posted as to what you're going to be doing in the future, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Carol, for having us.
Yeah, would love people to check out our website. I know you have it on your list there. We do individual mentoring as well as couples, and we also do some online groups. So, yeah.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. They can go to www.redeemedwarriors.com. That's Dan. And www.angieandrew.life. And if you need to get back with me, listening audience, to get those websites again, don't hesitate. All right, that's the end of the show. So as I say at the end of every show, you know, there will only be one of you at all times. I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself. You make next week a good week and look for ways for self-care. And don't forget Angie and Dan's website, redeemedwarriors.com, and angieandrew.life. We'll talk to you later.